Art Slice is a different dive into art history. We goof around, we curse, you learn from it, but don't expect a typical lecture. You're welcome. In 1963, expat surrealist Leonora Carrington made a one-of-a-kind painting.
A painting that feels lenticular in that it feels like it's shifting between layers depending on how you're like looking at it. Layers of brushstrokes, layers of geology, like jungle to city, sky to earth, mountains to underworld.
Layers of beliefs, like Mayan astronomy, the Popol Vuh, the differing Maya communities, secret rituals and curanderos, all interlaced with present-day Catholicism.
And all of that creates a cosmology of the past and present-day Maya, of course interpreted through Elsie's own lens.
And while Elsie had spent decades painting visions of fantastic figures living in otherworldly landscapes, inspired equally by her imagination and experience, capturing both the past and the modern-day descendants of one of the greatest civilizations in the world would be a unique challenge.
In typical Elsie fashion, we see that mixture of the ordinary with the magical.
Planets, gods and goddesses, mythical creatures, and regular-degular people just coexisting.
Like the bumper sticker.
Exactly, like the bumper sticker. But it wasn't entirely made up out of thin air. Sure, Ishel wasn't just floating around.
They weren't like giant rams that we know of.
Right.
That we can confirm.
Elsie would travel from her home in Mexico City to the mountainous highlands of Chiapas, where few tourists, especially expat tourists, would frequent, and where, over the course of a year, she would meet directly with Mayan descendants.
Even the most direct descendants, the Lacandon, who secluded themselves deep in the jungle, which meant they were not easy for those Spanish conquistadors to conquist. She visited sacred sites and monuments, observing and sketching local curanderos, where photography was discouraged.
She would take those sketches and all of those experiences back to her small studio in Mexico City, where she would work on her largest work yet, the 14-foot curved mural painting El Mundo Mágico de los Mayas, or The Magical World of the Maya. Welcome to Art Slice, a jovial dive into art history. I'm Stephanie Duenas.
I'm Russell Shoemaker.
Where we explore the who, what, when, where of artists, which, like in life, is not linear. It is not A to B. And it might involve a long journey that comes up empty-handed, a rabbit hole or two.
Maybe a bad case of altitude sickness, or in your case, maybe not altitude sickness. Maybe you just left your mouth open in the shower.
And then a second long journey, this time in an open-sided wooden train. So, let's all let go of the supposedas, okay? Because
someone's got a case of the supposedas.
And you don't want to be that person.
Yeah,
you don't want to be that somebody. No.
Do you want a case of the supposedas? It's hard to get rid of. It's not really a cure for it yet. People are pretty iffy about the vaccines for the supposedas.
All right, let go of the supposedas. We are about to go on a journey. And a winding one, because today we're finally diving back into the magical world of Leonora Carrington. Who we last covered in our last Tres Witches episodes. This time, we're covering her 1964 14-foot mural-sized curved painting.
And it's curved for your peripheral pleasure. Hard word to say, covers your peripheral vision.
This painting is called El Mundo Mágico de los Mayas, or The Magical World of the Maya, commissioned for the debut of the National Museum of Anthropology in Mexico City.
When you think of the Maya, who, to be clear, we are not at all experts on.
Please remember that throughout the episode.
Yes, thank you. You think of deeply esoteric and scientifically advanced astronomers, architects, artists, mathematicians, writers who had ruled the rainforest of Central America for 1,000 years. And survived centuries of Spanish colonization.
Which, yes, we agree, seems like an odd subject for the very British and very surrealist LC, despite being a Chilanga for more than 20 years at this point. But, as we will see, this naturally aligned with LC's own syncretistic worldview instilled in her by her nanny.
Oh, shit, her nanny.
Who read... Nanny. Who read her Celtic stories.
It's coming back.
From
it's coming
an
back
early yeah. age, yes.
And syncretism was what the post-colonial Maya used to preserve their deeply held beliefs, and that became actually commonplace over generations for the current-day descendants. Now they kind of, as we'll see, do a mixture of Catholicism with some Mayan traditions.
For instance, finding parallels between their fertility goddess Ixchel and the Virgin Mary, mother of Bibi J.
Mom.
Ma.
Mother. Mother.
Yes, that one.
And so what do we mean by syncretism? It's a blending of religions, philosophies, cultures, all of which are observably true as ideas. Like, you know, they always are churning, merging, evolving. And Elsie practiced this in her studio, melding surrealism with fantasy, astrology, brujeria, occultism, philosophy. I mean, so much, right? So much. And found all sorts of commonalities and connections between those interests.
And this mural, actually, was really high on our bucket list. We had wanted to see it for ourselves for, like, a long time, since the early days of Art Slice, believe it or not. And in 2024, we finally saved enough coins, and we bought a ticket to take the plunge to go to Mexico.
Uh-huh.
However,
What's the word?
Try not to cry. It's not available. It's on here. I'm trying to figure out where it is and why.
Why I didn't say that?
I didn't know about it.
Yeah.
But it's the whole second floor, right?
Most of it shut off. Yeah, I tried to get through.
That's what the guard was saying. She's like, I don't even think you can go upstairs. And then they were like, oh, it's not here.
You think it's at the opening tomorrow?
Best we could tell when we got there, a portion of the museum was actually out of commission,
or
closed off.
We're just dumbasses and couldn't find it.
No acceso, okay? It was actually being reinstalled for the then upcoming inauguration of current Presidenta Claudia Sheinbaum, but we're going to put a pin in that for right now. In this episode, we're going to catch you up on Elsie's life since we last left her as a recent immigrant living in Mexico City.
Trace the pre-colonial lineage of the Maya and get into how their lives were forever changed when a bunch of Spanish shitcoin investors arrived on the shores, which it's not on the shores, it's actually had to travel up into the highlands. But, you know, they got there via the shores.
Right.
And they made their way through.
We're going to connect all the dots that would lead Elsie to the current day Maya. Her firsthand experiences in Chiapas.
And of course, the actual mural, eventually.
Actually. But before all of that, we want to share what we think makes Elsie such a unique artist and person.
Y aquí está la pintora inglesa Leonora Carrington. Una sensibilidad despierta, una mano hábil, un ojo avisor, pero sobre todo, una imaginación creadora de primera línea.
When we last covered her in our Las Tres Witches episodes, along with her two witchy friends, Katy Horna and Remedios Varo, Elsie in particular stuck with us. Despite her growing popularity in recent years, most of which frames her as this kind of odd sorceress who was ultra serious.
She's an odd sorceress.
And she saw beyond the material world.
You need to respect her. She has the art that she sources. Magical spells.
Medical spells?
Go on.
Okay. Because, as it is framed today, she is portrayed as this kind of mysterious, like, art sorceress.
An alpha witch. She's kind of portrayed as an alpha witch.
There you go. Yeah. So, often the narratives about her focus mostly on the terrible experiences she survived in her early 20s, which was formative, but only a small portion of who she was.
And that, like, undercuts slash overlooks the years and hard work it took to move past all of that and cultivate a life of stability and joy, which is essential for an artist to be able to kind of pour themselves, much like a sauce from a saucepan into a little saucer, into your work. And by ignoring that part of their lives, it makes it seem inaccessible for other artists who might find their lives inspiring.
Right.
In Mexico City, she had very little money. She was raising two children, yet she was able to craft her life in a way that allowed her art practice to flourish.
And she could be intimidating, yes. Mm. She did not suffer those with ill intentions. But she was also a prankster, along with Remedios Varo. Okay, they would make fake caviar and hair omelets and pass them off to unsuspecting visitors.
Disgusting.
House guests, yes. And her very surrealist, very wry British sense of humor was often lost on both native-born Mexicans and expats alike.
One has to protect oneself. against demons. Very good for you.
What sort of demons are you likely to find in such a milk crate?
Well, I'm hoping to keep them away so I won't be able to identify them. If I have a radical change of personality, you'll know that it didn't work.
Sometimes she even exaggerated or made up stories, only copying to them years later. She was all about gender equality. She was non-monogamous. She peed, she pooed, she got her period.
Yeah.
Yes, okay, so she still gave off quite the aura, despite all her human qualities, okay? She also faced plenty of hardship, but that wasn't why she was a great artist, okay? The joy, the fun, and love of learning was the actual magical elixir for Elsie.
And that is something we can all work on cultivating in our lives despite any hard Scrabble we face in life.
Or in the game of Scrabble.
It's sort of like hard Scrabble. I'm trying to up my dictionary game here. Okay?
Love it.
My vocab, okay?
Exactly, right? This is very much what we're talking about right now.
Yeah.
Okay, so before we get into this episode officially, there are three things we want to say. First, let us remind any new listeners that our approach to art history is always a mixture of seriousness and silliness, if you couldn't tell already. Mm. So if that is not your bag...
Your shade of hair omelet. The dye that you would dye your hair in the hair omelet before it was turned into an omelet.
It's fine. It's fine if it's not your omelet or your bag, okay? But we don't want to hear how this degrades the legacy of fill-in-the-blank artist.
We also don't want to hear if we're bad at making omelets. I don't care. Still eggs. It's still a transport for eggs. Eggs are nutritious.
And delicious. Mm. Okay. So, new listener, if you're offended, take a beat. Okay, consider that Elsie and the Surrealists use provocative, absurdist humor to grapple with the tragedies of mankind. Mm. And also that your favorite artist might have not liked your rigid worldview.
Or your taste in omelets, okay?
Exactly. They actually might have served you a hairy omelet. Mm. Okay?
Yeah. Would you want to waste an egg? Exactly. A chicken had to produce that.
Yes.
You know what I mean? What color hair omelet would yours be?
Pink. Pink.
Okay. I think I would have emo bangs, probably a mixture of black and red. Much like my 20s, my 18s.
Your 18s? Mm-hmm. Oh, what about you listeners or ear buddies? Let us know what kind of omelet situation you would be.
Yeah.
Secondly, this one's a little nicer, y'all. Mm-hmm. We really want to say to our patrons and honestly to everyone who has supported us.
We're sorry we're late. We've been depressed about the world.
Yes.
So it's been delaying our podcast. But I'm trying to do a monster truck rally thing. I don't think it's really working. I don't think I'm really capturing it. But yeah, I don't know. Everybody else, we've been kind of bummed out, you know?
We have been so depressed.
Depressed. You got it, yeah.
We have personal problems. Personal issues.
We started going to therapy. But we're here. We're here to say thank you from the bottomest of our little corazones, okay? You all have been our rock, and because of your support, we were able to cobble enough together to go back to Mexico City last year, 2025, to try and find Elsie's mural.
And good thing, we might not be allowed there anymore.
True that.
Yeah.
Also, hopefully it's there this time.
Wink. Wink. Will it be there? Wink. We don't know. Wink.
Wish
we don't
us know. Luck. And
good job.
Yeah,
thank you. We're gesturing.
I'm so anxious. My little corazón is like this.
It's beating.
Oops. Yeah. Yes, because we are back for a second time.
Thirdly, like, subscribe, leave us a comment, a 5-star review if you're listening on Spotify. You can always switch from audio to video. There's a little button I think you press to make that happen. Or just go to YouTube. Or we'll try to maybe post on Internet Archive since, you know, there's no ads. And, you know, YouTube is also, you know, another big questionable corporation.
Right.
Also, Stephanie's about to have surgery. Everybody give her love. Give her love. She's a trooper.
By the time you're watching this, hopefully I'm better.
Hopefully she's still alive. Don't leave me. Swear to God, if you leave me these fucking cats.
And all these plants. All these cats and plants in this house. All right, y'all. Let's get into the episode. Let's go. Vámonos. Ciao. Goodbye. Let's go. Andiamo. Let's go. I'm going to keep talking. So this peregrination, trying not to say long journey again. Mm. So
good word.
Let's start where we last left.
That'd be a hard Scrabble word.
Peregrination?
Yeah.
Yes. All right. So let's start where we last left LC, which was right after she gets settled into her new home in Mexico City. The piece we covered, the house opposite from 1945, was a cozy cross-section of a house. The heart being the meal-making and potion-making. And we felt that it perfectly captured Elsie's experience healing and finally finding her own family. All in a place where the sun shines brighter 7,500 feet above sea level. From her lonely childhood in a strict and cold new money mansion, the size of a shopping mall, to her falling in love with Max Ernst and joining the Surrealists, only to be disowned by her family and cut off from her trust fund. Soon after, losing the life she had built with Max while fleeing Nazi-controlled France. Then being brought to the edge of death in Spain after winding up in a psychiatric hospital. All the way to her daring escape and final heartbreak and closure with Max in New York City. Mexico must have felt like a new start. Everything was different. The architecture, a blend of ornate Spanish colonial facades, Art Nouveau, and centuries-old church cupolas peeking above the skyline. You have strange trees, stout date palms, wiggly branched purple jacarandas, and Godzilla-sized versions of famous ficus plants like weeping figs and rubber trees, all creating a canopy of dappling sunlight on the sidewalks. While her home was filled to the brim with other immigrant roommates, close friends, probably a few enemies, ex-husbands, and future husbands, the house opposite, on the other hand, was filled with animals, children, spirits, and a cast of characters like Aunt Trita.
I think there was a silken, tofu-skinned ghost spirit thing that could slide through the floorboards.
There were bowling pin chickens waiting patiently to be thrown into boiling pots. A red-heeled spirit hiking a staircase to a child's fever dream, bringing a healing broth. Mm. A white horse woman waiting for her meal, which I think you, Russell, compared me to, stating that, and I quote, "I often whinnied and stomped when I wanted you to cook me dinner," end quote.
Yeah, doesn't sound like something I'd say, I don't think. So I think you're wrong. I think you're misremembering things. It's been a while, so understandable.
And then, yes, three witch friends all huddled around a very chic cauldron, one bare-chested, one in a golden cloak, and the other in this beautiful starry cape, which, by process of elimination, was you, since you did all the cooking and I was doing all the horsing.
You're doing the horsing around. Yeah. Once again, I don't think I said that, but I do. Thank you. I do often like to make a stock, and yes, I would like a starry cape to keep my shoulders warm. Mm-hmm. I feel like the stock would heat me here, but maybe wouldn't radiate to my shoulders.
Okay. Yeah. Cape is necessary. Mm-hmm.
The house opposite also showed a shift in her work. Like, Elsie had begun using tempera and thinner washes of oil paint, which we thought was the missing component in her early Paris era work, because it really amplified that luminous, liminal quality and was a better vehicle to blend her painterly and illustrative styles, like, actually together.
Yes, which is a good reminder for you artist listeners to try different mediums, because sometimes those small changes will just open up a whole new world for you.
A whole new world.
Whole
Don't you
new world.
Close your eyes. Don't you dare do it.
I'm surprised you've seen that movie. Among all those roommates were her closest friends, the two other witches at the cauldron, Katy Horna and Remedios Varo. Elsie falls in love with and marries mutual friend of Kati's, Hungarian photographer and concentration camp survivor, Cheeky
Friendly,
Wise.
Friendly face. Cheeky Wise.
Friendly face. Mm. He's got a friendly face. Mm-hmm. And a head.
The face extends to the head. It's all friendly all the way up and into the back. And down the neck.
Okay.
And back around the neck and up again.
Okay.
Through her friendship with Kati and Varo and their shared interest in the supernatural, they collectively discovered beyond the physical world the translucent layers of
Ciudad de Mexico.
Mexico City. Its painful, violent, colonial, and revolutionary past made it a place where many mythologies could coexist, like a low aperture drag or the bumper sticker coexist.
Wow, callback. Okay.
Yeah. So you don't see those anymore.
Right, callback.
No, hey, nobody want to coexist no more. Don't know why. Don't know why we don't want to coexist. I don't want to coexist with these people.
Yeah.
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 That's where we're at. All right.
This wasn't WASPy England, where Elsie grew up, where things were black and white, good or bad. Mexico was a melting cauldron of Catholicism, Afro-Caribbean myths, alchemy, and brujería.
And Elsie's world was always one of connection, like Irish fairy tales, paganism, Poe, Carol, Hinduism, Buddhism, Jung, Freud, male, female. Nothing is more sacred than the other. Everything was interchangeable and fluid.
As the years progressed, Elsie, Cheeky, and her soon-to-be children moved into the now super trendy Roma neighborhood on Chihuahua Street.
Yep, yep.
Still small her home.
Dog. Chihuahua's a small dog. Go ahead.
It is. Chihuahua is a small dog. Good job. Good job. Yes. In case you guys didn't know, that's a Chihuahua.
Yeah.
And Elsie lived on Chihuahua Street. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that home would be her home until 2011 when she passed away. And if you're wondering how Elsie is regarded in Mexico today, the National Autonomous University of Mexico felt that it was such an important cultural site that they purchased it for posterity. It's at least not an Airbnb. We can be thankful for that.
Yet. Not an Airbnb yet.
Roma is infamous
Soon,
for all the Airbnbs.
All of expats moving there.
And Elsie's artist studio was once described as, quote, a combined kitchen, nursery, bedroom, kennel, and junk store, end quote. Sounds like our house, honestly. Mm. Where she could often be found painting in one hand and child rearing in the other. When she wasn't, she would visit the nearby Aztec pyramids of the sun and moon, traveling alongside anthropologist and ethnologist Laurette Sejourne to meet curanderos. Curanderos are spiritual healers who, like Mexico itself, use a mixture of indigenous and colonial traditions, among others, in their practice. Sejourne would document their beliefs for her book, Supervivencias de un Mundo Mágico, of which Elsie would eventually contribute accompanying illustrations. Mm. Of course, Elsie and Varo also experimented with brujería themselves. Mm. Think market halls that included tinctures, charms, crystals, rare seeds, incense, herbs and spices like epazote, cinnamon, clove, and oregano. And they dove into the source of many of the indigenous mythologies like the Aztec Codex and especially the Quiche Maya Popol Vuh, a reality where cosmology, magic, and transmutation were commonplace, where mountains, caves, and cenotes acted as portals between heaven, earth, and the underworld, and where deities like Quetzalcoatl or Kulkulkan, Huatlicue or Ixchel could directly shape human destiny.
The osmosis of all these spiritual layers propelled them both from your more run-of-the-mill surrealism to the fantastical, magical realism they are associated with today. Worlds that just couldn't be summarized by only like winks and nods to psychoanalyst jargon. And I would argue those Aztec and Maya influences can be found represented as primordial seas, mountain-dwelling creatures, and underworld caves.
Life, while still a gift considering all of the death that these artists confronted in Europe, still wasn't free. Life was still lifing. And Elsie and Cheeky were constantly living on the edge of poverty, as she once put it. Cheeky would bring in what he could from his job as an event photographer.
I'm imagining like a wedding photographer.
Right. That was
whatever the equivalent was in like 1940.
Elsie, despite having two chamacos at home, seemed yet even more prolific, churning out work after work and selling it when collectors showed an interest.
Her work had caught the attention of Edward James, an eccentric curator and surrealist collector, which you listeners may know back from Rene Magritte's portrait of his black suit. Backside, the black suit, backside, staring into a mirror, which, surprise, Magritte, reflected not his face, but the same black suit backside. So a whole kind of weird circle, weird sort of infinite circle that's incorrect.
And one of those sides was actually so taken by Elsie's work that he curated a solo show of her works in New York City in 1947. Unfortunately, she was unable to attend, but he visited her in Mexico City, where she gifted him the house opposite. We're coming full circle.
But only the backside of the full circle. The circle is seeing the back of its own circle.
Oh, shit. That's scary.
The exterior ring, not the interior. Like, so, like you would, yeah. So, like this. Here's the circle.
Okay.
The circle's like this, right? And it's seeing its reflection, but not the front facing circle that's facing the mirror. They're seeing the back facing circle, which you listeners might think is the same exact circle because it's still a circle. So it still looks like the circle is facing the circle, right? Mm-hmm. But instead it is the backside. And that's why they printed front and back on the circle. So you know.
I hope that circle can do yoga because that really hurt my neck.
You have to envision it. I'll draw it for you.
Please do. LC participated in the local art scene, making appearances as an extra in movies like Los Olvidados and En Este Pueblo No Hay Ladrones. She produced the play Penelope with surrealist director Alejandro Jodorowsky, and it would take a few more years before Mexican galleries would take notice of Elsie's work. Her first debut was a solo show in 1950 at not a white box gallery, but an interior design firm.
Nice.
Considering Mexico City was filled to the brim with art, typically murals of socially minded realism, prints, or arte popular, what Elsie made was very different. Kind of small to mid-sized works, fantastical, deeply personal, with a weirdo cast of characters, kind of abstract, and generally inscrutable. She could have been ignored, or worse, it could have fallen flat on an audience that just wasn't prepared for it.
Right.
But instead, the show drew a lot of positive attention, garnering glowing reviews, calling her work poetic, fantastical, mysterious, with the, quote, clarity and immaculate simplicity of a primitive,
ooh,
end quote.
Primitive, okay.
Primitive.
Okay, yeah.
Mid-20th century.
Compliment.
It was that at that time.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. So aside from calling Elsie primitive, again, which was well intended for the time, they also misspelled her name in the headline. We have Leonora Larrington. Leonora Larrington. Okay. All right.
Maybe you had a bite of a donut. It's like when people try to pronounce my name in Mexico. No offense. Love it.
Like what?
I can't. The guy, we had it's not DoorDash, but whatever the equivalent of DoorDash in Mexico City is.
Didi,
thank you. Very proud when he said my name wrong and I couldn't correct him. Because why would you? Why would you correct somebody, listeners, if perhaps someone mispronounces Remedios as Remedios?
Why would you correct them? Or
Or Van Gogh.
There's a time to correct people. As someone who speaks more than one language, there's a time to correct people.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
We need to be generous with people.
Let me be clear. I'm the one being corrected, not the other way around. Anyway.
Remember when you tried to say Cuatlicue?
Shut the fuck up. Let's take a brief moment to look at the kind of work Elsie was making around this time. Now, we know that it's foolish to try and kind of mine Elsie's work for meaning.
Beep, beep. It's me mining.
It's you mining?
Uh-huh.
And Elsie would, out of the way. She herself refused to do this.
I think to paint the paintings and then have some art historian come along and ask, you know, you to sort of talk about them.
Yeah, that's what art historians do, don't they?
Yes.
They lay down laws, but I don't go along with the laws.
No, but it must be hard having the art historians coming along afterwards.
It's not hard, because I ignore what they say.
But we want to give you a taste of how she combines specific moments that she might have experienced in real life with fantasy, astrology, history, and then just a bunch of wonderfully weird shit.
And we mean weird in the in brackets good. Bracket weird brackets good.
Wonderfully weird.
Yeah. I don't know if you heard that, listeners, who take offense with our word choice sometimes.
It personally. Can't help you. Anyway, we chose Cheek of Your Country from 1944, Oil, Temper, and Ink on Canvas, because it's one of her most obviously autobiographical works, and it precedes her book, The Stone Door. Both works address this time in her life in their own surrealist way. But Cheek of Your Country is specifically indicative of the wild narratives and multitudes of meaning Elsie layers atop complex compositions, which we will see her utilize in her Mayan mural decades later.
First example, while this is a jam-packed, horror-vacuum-y-pilled composition, especially for its size, which is approximately like two medium-sized flat-screen TVs stacked on top of one another. Mm. Like the house opposite, no single clear main character emerges. Mm-hmm. There's not one focal point that the rest of the composition supports, as in the case with most canvas paintings in general, or even other works of LC's like The Giantess. Not only that, but everything depicted is contained in craggy, oblong, organic-like shapes to the point where the ripples of a cloth feel similar to the rollings of a green hill. Our POV is a bird's eye verging on map-like view, and the composition is split one-third sky, two-thirds earth, all depicted somewhere in the small to even smaller scale. All these details, decipherable and indecipherable, hint at multiple interconnected narratives and stories being constructed.
Similar to how Bruegel and Bosch's loaded compositions allow your ojito, your little eye, to move from one story to the next.
Yeah, that's the Where's Waldo effect, I think.
Like the children's book?
Yeah, children's book, sure. It's one of the ages.
How?
What do you mean how?
Is that actually called the world's Waldo?
It's the world's Waldo? It's Waldo's world. Where's Waldo?
Is that actually an effect? There's so many effects. Is that actually an effect?
Yeah, in my mind it is.
Okay. So
there's research papers done on it.
Okay. So this isn't like the Northern Renaissance paintings, right? With all of their multiple vignettes, the busy compositions, all the fine detail and symbolism maybe that Elsie might have studied.
Yes, and the Where's Waldo's effect. And Waldo's first of all, it's not a children's book, it's ages five and up. And they have a lot more in common than you would think. Stephanie. Spreadsheet. Okay. Sometimes they call Stephanie Spreadsheet.
You know what?
It's her nickname.
Thank you. It is Spreadsheet. Yeah. Bet you never heard that one. I see it. I just don't get it, like, you know, timeline-wise. Uh-huh.
There's no way to know. There's no way to know because all there is now is AI. And by the time this is released, there's probably not even libraries. So how are you going to, like, do a, you know, peer-studied review to know if Hanford, the creator of Where's Waldo, wasn't around sometime in, like, the Northern Renaissance? In the little ears, a little earworm, and for Bosch, he could have been, you know,
whispering.
Little Waldo peeking out of Bosch's ear, his giant ear in his paintings, telling him how to create his compositions. You don't know that.
It could be.
We don't know that.
We don't know. I don't know. You don't know.
I don't know why I'm getting so worked up about this, but it could have been a major influence.
It could have been, and I'm not going to fight you on that. But I'm going to add that I can also see Mexican muralism being an influence.
Yeah. In Sunday afternoon in Almeida Park. Did I say that right?
Yeah, that's close enough.
Close enough.
For a white guy.
Waldo-esque.
Actually, yeah.
Waldo-esque.
You know what? I bet Waldo's
in there somewhere.
Uh-huh. A 1930s, 40s Waldo. Or 20s. I forgot what that painting was.
Bruegel, Bruegel, Durer, Bosch, Carrington, Hanford. All pioneers.
Hey, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. You know what? Actually, we should do a bonus on Where's Wally. Mm. Because...
if we can find him.
Get the fuck out of here. So with that Northern Renaissance / Waldo-esque bird's eye POV in Cheekier Country, you might assume that it would allow for a vast, expansive landscape with a foreground and a middle ground. Mm-hmm. But instead, where the sky meets the earth and the landscape is at its deepest and its depthiest, it is obstructed. Okay, it's blocked by a procession of four figures, giants, a similar shape to the clouds above and the mountains below.
In typical Elsie fashion, she is foiling the expectations, keeping us from those beautiful vistas, undercutting that realistic space and replacing it with portals, windows, diagrams, dissections, which flatten and fragment and just throw us off kilter, while keeping a similar compositional weight throughout, which is pretty unnerving. And that's due partially to the way she handles her brushstrokes, using those hundreds of, like, rhythmic marks with the smallest brushes and thin translucent layers so that the light will bounce off of that canvas. Mm-hmm. That part, that is very Northern Renaissance.
Right.
So I do agree with you there.
Right. So unlike the rest of the piece, right, which kind of feels Where's Waldo-y, Donde está Wally-esque, right?
Which also, if I'm looking at Cheekier Country, I'm seeing a lot of white, I'm seeing a lot of red, I'm seeing a lot of blue, not American, and black, okay? And this... in this painting.
Yeah.
So if you kind of squint your eyes, just let your eyes unfocus, and refocus.
Okay.
The whole painting could be like it could be a deconstructed Waldo in and of itself, just because of the colors. Those are famously his colors.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah.
All right. I can see it. Mm-hmm. This is like an optimal. What is optimal? An optical effect.
An
those
optimal
posters
illusion.
From like the 70s, 80s, and
90s. I will agree. I know. I totally agree with you there. Waldo is an optimal illusion.
Optimal illusion?
Optimal illusion.
Optimal illusion.
Optimal art.
Okay. But
optimal
we don't know.
Illusory art.
No sabemos.
That's a word, right? Illusory.
It is now. Spell it out right here. There we go. Okay.
Cheeky's distinct dome, receding hairline, and friendly face is depicted along with Elsie in the window of a red cloth chariot. Of course, not your everyday chariot. This is Elsie we're talking about here. It's bed-like and top-heavy with a weird diorama on top. She once was a diorama maker, I think, with Varo back in Mexico City when they were looking for jobs. Anyway, I remember that from a long time ago.
Yeah, good pull.
And they're being pulled by a floating leopard rug with ram horns and a long, devilish red tail,
nice.
Much like mine. Connected to the chariot, not by a harness. I am a little stinker. Connected to the chariot, not by a harness, but by a branch. Which sounds like a company that you get your sheets from.
By a branch?
Mm-hmm. Harness and branch.
Harness and branch. Yeah, there you go. Harness and branch. Good one.
Within the carriage's suspension and spokes are more hidden symbols and some vulture-like creatures who are kind of skitching on the side of it.
Skitching.
Yeah, skitching.
Bitching. Mm. In said window vignette, Elsie seems to be spooning Cheeky,
okay.
Her little hand sticking out of the red curtain, holding the other end of that branch, right, that harness and branch, of which some sort of bag / vessel precariously hangs in midair, perhaps a late night Didi delivery.
Oh, delicious. And
it is delicious.
Yeah.
So this is an inversion of your typical gender stereotype, right? Mm. Girl is driving. Girl is getting the Didi order. Girl is the big spoon.
Mm.
La big cuchara. Okay.
Okay.
As the proud female big spoon in our relationship, mm-hmm. I love to see it.
Yeah. She's the big spoon. Sometimes I wish it was a little bit more equitable of a spoon division, but here we are. 10 years later. 10? 11. 10.5. 10.5 years later. She's
okay.
Like, sometimes I'll just like, I wedge myself against the couch. You know, if we're like watching a movie, I'll wedge myself against the couch. All my strength, all the strength
okay.
I have in my little body. And she's just like Alex Mack style. Turns into like jello and just like seeps behind me, even though I'm just like pressing, like
yeah.
I feel the squish of the like jello popping up, splattering everywhere,
yeah.
But it reconstitutes as Stephanie right behind me, and then I
yeah.
like shift forward.
Yeah.
Really frustrating.
You shift.
Mm.
Or
it's
I
a
just
cool power to have, though.
Pull you away with your little tail. Just pull the tail.
Yeah.
Yeah. That
the
works
tail
too.
Gives me extra strength, too, which is great.
Doesn't, apparently.
Yeah. Well, not enough.
Once again. We don't know what Elsie means here.
Mm.
She keeps it mysterious, even to herself.
I'm always a bit afraid of defining things too much. I think whatever there is to see is there to be seen without defining it.
As artists, we know that sometimes you spend a ton of time on a single work, and naturally, your world and the world you are creating start to meld.
Mm. And I'm sure you artist listeners can relate. For me, like, my paintings feel like they're scattered journal entries at times.
Mm-hmm.
They have, like, inside jokes. They have things I'm just, like, molding over. You know, maybe it's just, like, a shape that felt right. You know, shit, that feels weird to say. But it's
intuitive.
Feels right to paint. They don't necessarily have to have like a through line at all. And, you know, and none of what I experience in making the work is important for the viewer to know. But, you know.
But a viewer might take something right. from that, even if it's not what you or I would
mm-hmm.
take from it.
Okay. Exactly.
Exactement. And that seems to very much be the case for Elsie. Fragments of moments, real and imaginary, maybe referencing Cheeky's escape from concentration camps and his journey to Mexico City. Their lives coming together and them making new life together.
And the weird-ass feet sticking out of the chariot curtain.
Yes.
When
I
your feet
it.
Get a little hot under the covers.
Yeah.
You got to get those little piggies some air.
Splam out.
Stephanie, very relatable.
Splam out.
Good air between the toes.
Yes. That's the best feeling.
Very Norman Rockwell-esque. slice of life here.
Right. Below the chariot.
Big toes pointing towards it.
Yeah, so helpful. Thank
mm-hmm.
you. Is another craggy oblong shape, this time a cutaway cross-section.
Mm, which acts as like a painted diagram in a painting that already feels kind of like a diagram in some ways. And it reads as the parallel forces aligning to make whatever is happening in this painting possible.
Yes, yes. And it's depicted as el sol, or the sun. Its beams divide and define the myriad of symbols and moments, both above and below the earth. In the center, alchemical symbols and their associated planets are stacked on the rungs of a ladder.
Alchemists believe that astronomy correlated to earthly metals and minerals.
Mm-hmm. So, we're going somewhere. Yeah. Yes. We have quicksilver, mercury, copper, Venus, maybe lead, Saturn, iron, Mars, maybe a moon symbol, not sure, possibly bismuth, Neptune, maybe Uranus, maybe. And the last symbol, we're actually not quite sure about. It kind of gets muddled. So let us know if you happen to know, listeners.
Or assume Jupiter, right?
Jupiter.
Process of elimination. Or right. Pluto, because Pluto was still a planet then.
Was it?
I think so.
I don't know.
Maybe it wasn't even discovered then. Who knows? No way of, like I said, no way of knowing.
Yes, I do think that chemistry has something to do with alchemy. And I think sexual attraction has to do with chemistry. And chemistry has to do with alchemy and sexual attraction. And it's all very...
What else is floating around this sun diagram, you might be asking yourselves, dear ear buddies. Mm-hmm. Okay. We have a pentagram with a five gone, layered below a Fatima-style hand, possibly an evil eye, within a black circle, giving magic eight ball, okay, and then surrounded by a wreath. By a wreath, a leafy wreath.
The hand looks like the Tsunome Yokai, kind of, or Pan's Labyrinth is probably like the most relatable reference.
Yes.
But yeah, scary.
And still in that eight ball, there is a treble clef. And on top of that, the number 72 marked at one point of the pentagram.
Which is likely referencing the equinox, where the Earth's axis... Oh my God, that's so hard to say. where the planet's axis... Access Hollywood.
Access
planet. Access Earth. Okay, wow. The Earth's axis shifts 1 degree every 72 years. In Kabbalah, 72 is also the god number for reference. I learned that in Hilma off Clint.
Okay, you took that nugget with you. So yeah, we just rapidly spitfired a ton of stuff at you, and there's so much more that we could mention. Mm. But also we're gonna move along. Along the rotation of the rays, there are other dismembered and reassembled creatures.
Flattened like rugs, of course.
Yes. A dinosaur-ish skeleton, alchemical pots and beakers, a woman split between above ground and below, black hair above, below blonde, and also a penis.
Yeah.
What looks to be a female symbol floats around them. But instead of the cross at the bottom, which would be the female symbol, there is the male arrow instead. Mm. The sign for female is also the symbol for the planet Venus.
Important later.
Which was made to look like a hand mirror.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because women always be looking at mirrors, fellas.
And men always be looking at women. In the stone door.
In the mirror, like behind... While they're looking at, like, the reflection?
No, just with their eyes. Also, a hand mirror could be a phone, a screen at this juncture.
Yeah.
In her book, The Stone Door, while insanely cryptic and surreal, like this painting, is very much inspired by Cheeky and Elsie's lives. One such character writes in her diary, quote, "Lovers get drunk on bitter milk. I am hermaphrodite in love with one of my own dreams. Beast fed with the shade of a dry funeral cake."
Funnel cake.
End quote. Minus the funnel cake. Okay. Oh, I mean, if you want to talk about what I think are typos here, we can talk. We can certainly talk about that. It's another one. Breastfed with the shade of funnel cake.
Yeah, no, I always think that when I read that,
okay,
I was like, breastfed?
Breastfed.
Is that a
also,
misprint?
Also, lovers get drunk on buttermilk. Mm. That is what I thought.
Lovers get drunk on buttermilk. Breastfed. Oh, it is funeral. Oh, you said funnel.
No, I said funeral. You said funnel.
Yeah, okay.
You know what this is? This reminds me of Leonora Larrington.
I'm the dummy. All right, I admit it. I'm the dummy. I fucked up.
We're a little bit dyslexic. Okay. All right.
With everything else, you would think it was funnel cake. I'm sorry.
All right.
I'm going to go back to hermaphrodite. Okay, so that term is now considered derogatory. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this wasn't Elsie's intent. It shows how her figures are often fluid and interchangeable between binaries.
And I also think it shows how she saw herself in context of, like, social norms, right?
Right, right. And this is just one tiny piece of a small cross-section of this painting.
Zooming back out, back into the rest of the painting, we see a radish-shaped figure cloaked in white, holding a pot and a golden, I don't know, an instrument? Probably an instrument, okay. Something. With a black volcanic-looking shaped balaclava atop
her head. Not baklava.
Baklava, the food? Balaclava, the head. Not the okay.
You know what? I bet this is a.
What did I say?
You said the right thing. I fucked it up. I was trying to trip you up. It didn't work.
You were trying to. Okay.
I was trying to learn Norlarentine. It didn't work.
The baklava, balaclava, is tied to a kite floating above that northern Renaissance style landscape. And even this landscape shifts. Like some areas are icy, some ashy, some desolate. And this white figure seems to be processing all of these cycles of life, death, and stagnation, then sending that growth and music, probably music, back into these worlds.
She is just layering so much, yeah. Okay? And there's just so much more that we're not going to get to.
Like, we didn't even get into the dystopic diorama atop the red bed chariot.
We would also...
From Branch and Harness.
From Branch and Harness. Oh, was it a Harness
boutique,
and Branch?
Actually, I'm updating this. A boutique BDSM store.
That's good. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Who
I love
doesn't
that.
Want like a sort of like triant-themed BDSM wear? I don't know what we're not kinky like that because I don't know what it's called, but
someone out there does.
Yeah,
there's
someone
a market
does,
out
and
there.
Someone wants it, and we should do it. Trademarked. It's ours. Don't do it.
We're running.
You can cut us in. You can cut us in. Anyway, go on.
Okay.
What were we talking about? Elsie, funnel cakes.
Funnel cakes, dry cakes, hermaphrodites. Okay. No, I want to talk to the listener and the ear buddies. Okay. Mm-hmm. What other areas of this painting is really resonating with you if you're following along? So you should be following along. But just to note, she is going to take this approach to layering and dissecting multitudes of meanings, perspectives, and time in her Maya mural. Then, just a few years later, in 1956, she lands her first solo show at the Galería de Arte Mexicana, or GAM, housed in a Porfirian-era mansion. This was a big deal. The gallery owner, Ines Amor, had opened GAM in 1935, mostly showing smaller works from the big Mural 3, Rivera, Clemente Orozco, Siqueiros, but the times were a-changing. Okay, younger artists, including quite a few expats, were experimenting and breaking away from the more direct, didactic, and socially conscious realism of the Mexican muralists to something that was a little more personally derived, right? Works that were not necessarily intended only for the general public. Mm. And these artists were starting to stake their claim in Mexico, becoming known as la generación de la ruptura, or the breakaway generation for breaking away from the tradition of the past 30 years. And Elsie was about to find herself riding this wave. Cowabunga. Surf's up, dude.
Broski.
Flip your hair. You gotta flip.
Cowabunga. Broski.
Doski.
Catching the waves. I used to work at a racket club in California, and the old guys would always talk to me about all the waves they caught in the morning. And they were like, how are you doing, man? Are you, like, catching the waves? And I'm like, you're, like, 55. How is it not breaking all of your bones, dog?
Because they've been catching waves since they were five.
They got the bone resilience to, like, you know, master those... Oh, fuck, I'm losing it. Waves, dog. Right. I had to shut the fuck up.
Cowabunga.
And now, here to begin tonight's true story adventure is Jack Douglas.
Many centuries ago, even before the Aztecs, there lived a race of people who created a mighty civilization in Central America, whose engineers raised buildings rivaling the pyramids of Egypt, whose astronomers perfected a scientific calendar, whose art we treasure even today. These were the Mayans, who once were believed to have perished with their civilization. But as we know, the Mayans did not disappear from the face of the earth. A small handful of their descendants are still living in virtually primitive state in the jungles of the Mexican-Guatemalan border. And here to give us a new look at the last of this ancient race is Mr. Donald Rathlow of Toronto, Canada. Hi, Mr. Rathlow. Welcome to our program series.
Stephanie, listeners, spreadsheet, it's time for Gringo Explains Indigenous Culture.
Yay!
Everybody clap and join Professor Shoemaker as he explains Indigenous culture. Something I know a lot about.
But not much. Not that much, but actually kind of.
Something I read a lot about recently. Unlike the Mexica, who were named the Aztecs later by the Europeans, we're going to refer to them as Aztecs, though, just for simplicity, who primarily resided in the mountainous highland basin of Mexico on Lake Texcoco, now Mexico City. Mayan civilizations resided in the diverse tropical jungles of southern Mexico and extended past current-day borders into what is now Belize, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador.
Fun fact, the origin of the word Guatemala, Stephanie, the accent.
Guatemala.
The origin of the word Guatemala comes from the Nahuatl translation, Guatemayan, meaning place of the many trees.
Mm-hmm.
People, I think.
People of the many trees.
Yes. Gotcha. Just a fun fact.
Mm. Chiapas, the southernmost state, sharing a border with Guatemala, is still where many Mayan descendants call home and where many Mayan works of art and temples stand.
And where you can still hear Maya and Xochitl spoken alongside Spanish.
Aside from these important monuments, Chiapas is one of the most beautiful and biologically diverse regions in the world. Its rugged landscapes vary from mountains to emerald waters, at times accessible only via cenotes, to dense jungles, where despite centuries of modernization and deforestation, you could still find an array of tree, animals, and insect species, many of those endangered.
Red macaws, eagles, swamp crocodiles, spider, and howler monkeys, known for their nightmare-inducing
sounds. Give me a little howler monkey flavor. Well, that's pretty good. That's good.
Can I go deeper?
Yeah, please. Whoa.
Dude, that was closer. That was it. You're welcome.
I'm a little scared.
Don't YouTube any videos.
I'm just gonna
kill me now.
Put your voice over the image of a howler monkey, and I think it'll be pretty accurate. I don't think anyone will know the difference.
Do that. Thanks.
Terrified. And the adorable odd-toed, worm-nosed ungulate tapir or taper, depending on your flavor of pronunciation. Pronunciation. And jaguars, of course. Thank you.
Okay. I can't do that one. Let's cut that one. And jaguars.
If you consider the narratives that the mural is frescoed to walls, you might rightfully assume that all the indigenous peoples have been completely genocided off of the continent by the Spanish conquistadors. And it is true that the Spanish faced relatively little difficulty conquering the Aztecs in Tenochtitlan, a wide open space that geographically played into the invaders' technological strengths. Muskets, cannons, horses, and infantry just brimming with syphilis, measles, and smallpox.
It's disgusting.
Yeah, they're pretty gross.
Because the Spanish were so able to thoroughly defeat the centralized Aztecs, the indigenous almost entirely lost their connection to their culture. Many of their temples were destroyed, the stones then used to build cathedrals.
As we mentioned in our Diego episode, statues like Coatlicue were rediscovered centuries later, only to be promptly reburied because the indigenous started to bring offerings to Coatlicue instead of Jesus,
yes,
who is a carpenter at the local furniture store. Okay. And while there is an Aztec codex, its accuracy is questioned because it was made under Spanish supervision. We mention this because the Maya of southern Mexico were much, much more difficult for the conquistadors to conquist. The army that was enlisted to invade Chiapas were more like independent contractors than the well-trained soldiers under Cortez. Basically just like Uber drivers who were sold like a shitcoin. Ponzi scheme.
Mm-mm.
And they were especially ill-suited for the war of attrition that was going to be needed for this region. The dense rainforests, steep mountain terrain, were always going to favor the indigenous because they were indigenous to the land.
Right.
Cannons and horses were no help when Maya could set up traps and sever supply lines. mostly avoiding hand-to-hand combat altogether. Not to mention the jungle itself could easily bring disease and, importantly, fear to the Spanish. Unlike the Aztecs, the Maya were also never a unified empire. They were smaller, independent kingdoms that had ruled for 1,000 years. And while the Maya had already been decimated by famine and wars amongst each other by the time the Spanish arrived, the remaining factions were ferocious fighters and totally decentralized. Those who were captured, once sick of the Spanish shitcoin investors' shit, might set their crops on fire and run off to join another Maya faction, who they, all bad blood aside, obviously favored over the invaders.
Slowly, the Spanish won out, but all of these Maya sects, like the Tzotzil and Tetzel, still remained. They still had thriving communities that remained separate while working under colonial oppression. Mm. For example, wool was important enough to the Spanish for them to import sheep to that region. So the Tzotzil became sheep herders out of coercion, which became their main source of income and a major part of their lives today. This is another example of syncretism.
Others like the Lacandon completely disappeared deep into the jungle, living a life completely removed where the Spanish knew that the juice, that jungle juice, was not worth the squeezing of the jungle fruits, okay? What with all the howler monkeys and crocodiles and carnivorous jungle ants and crossbow-wielding tapirs or tapirs.
Sure.
They fire it with their wiggly noses.
They said, nah.
No, that's how they fire it. They go like,
okay. Like, no, I meant the Spanish like, saw that.
Their whole thing moves and it's like...
Okay, Professor Shoemaker.
That's how I teach my class. This is how I teach my class.
You teach your class like that? Okay. Okay.
Please read the next line.
Okay, great. So, despite all of these unfortunate events, a really unique set of circumstances developed in Chiapas. Spanish cities like San Cristobal de las Casas are being erected.
Luckily, far enough removed from like those Mayan temples, so they weren't in danger of being leveled for materials like in Mexico City. And the Mayas continued to clash with the invaders for several centuries, not decades, centuries, okay? For a long time. Long time clash time.
And this whole time, you have all of these different communities working within colonialism. Mm-hmm. Okay, they're resisting it, or they are just completely removing themselves from it.
So there were all these levels of colonialism instead of just like one big colonial empire like Mexico City.
Mm-hmm. So all this is to say, the Mayas' connection to their indigenous culture was never fully erased. It was just syncretized, mm-hmm. first begrudgingly. With Catholicism, often in the form of, you know, like Saint da-da-da is a little bit like our goddess da-da-da. Mm. So I guess we can pray to Santa da-da-da-da, right? Right? Winky face.
Yeah, winky
I'm just going to say it. Winky face. Okay. Winky face.
And the saint's name was da-da-da?
Yeah.
And the Mayan's god was da-da-da?
Yeah.
It's pretty...
It's in the spelling.
It's eerie.
It's in the spelling.
And, you know, we're going to see that their beliefs do share some universal similarities, okay?
And even today, while Catholicism is by far the dominant religion, it has a uniquely Mayan flair in Chiapas.
We also need to mention that the K'iche' Maya Popol Vuh is far more detailed in contrast to the Aztec Codex and is considered highly accurate, as you can find corroborating evidence carved on the walls of ancient temples. But also... because of the decentralized Mayan kingdoms, many sects had differing beliefs than the Popol Vuh.
The Mexican War of Independence would eventually come, followed by the Mexican Revolution. Despite this, Chiapas continued to be one of the most oppressed and poorest states in Mexico, and its enduring revolutionary spirit eventually led to movements like the Zapatistas.
I mean, yeah, I was basically a Zapatista myself, Stephanie.
Oh. Oh,
to buy
professor?
A Rage Against the Machine shirt at Hot Topic.
Wow.
So. Pretty woke.
No.
It's pretty woke.
Okay.
Woke. Okay. And as feckless as that sounds, because it does sound feckless, it was probably a net positive because, you know, it does help open a rural Midwesterner's eyes and who's surrounded by, like, you know, the bush bubble. So
right.
It is helpful.
Your gringo eyes were opened.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm a professor now. Thank you. And we're not done yet. I promise this is all relevant. To connect the Maya with LC, we're going to have to talk about Trudé.
I'm not going to talk about
Trudy.
In fact, we're not going to talk about Trudy at all.
Gordon.
Enter Trudy, Gertrude Duby Blom, who is as Swiss as she sounds, as Swiss as she please. Trudy was a horticulturist, journalist, social worker, and socialist organizer.
From the very outset, her views were unorthodox and her manner rebellious. School bored her, and her studies soon gave way to the lure of the rivers and trees.
She was, like the Trace Witches, an obstinate, continent-hopping badass, moving to Nazi Germany to directly report on the Hitler regime, bouncing to Paris to recruit for the Antifa, which landed her in a prison camp and eventually deportation. Instead of backing down, she instigated in fascist Italy and raised funds for refugees while in New York City.
New York City.
But hearing of Mexico's open-door policy for political asylum seekers, she packed her bags and she moved to Mexico.
Trudy came to Mexico in 1940. As a journalist, she wrote about the women who had worked in the poorest factories of Mexico and became intrigued with the Zapatista women who fought in the Revolutionary Army of General Emilio Zapata.
Like my great-grandma Francisca. Rest in peace.
Badass.
Struck
by the revolutionary spirit of the Mexican people, Trudy, also like the Trace Witches, made Mexico her home and began her life's work in Chiapas, where she met and would accompany her husband-to-be, Franz, on his archaeological work. Discovering lost Mayan temples and art, Trudy would document the struggles and customs of the Tzotzil people in beautiful photographs, often speaking with them to understand their customs and the nuances of their unique belief systems. But something else was happening. Okay, that long-lost Maya group, who the Spanish realized they couldn't track down because of the jungle juice, the squeezing of the juice that makes the jungle juice, the Lacandon, had slowly started to reemerge from the jungles as modern industry was beginning to hack away at their sacred forests. So the Bloms decided they would go visit them in the forests.
At that time, Gertrudis Duby Blom and Pancho Franz Blom arrived. Gertrudis Blom was wearing a pair of pants from the Mexican Revolution. The people were afraid of that and thought she was a military person with firearms. We didn't know. Gertrudis told us to not be afraid because she was coming here to learn to be our friend. She would bring machetes, files, and other gifts which were very useful. She told him that there would be more people coming to occupy the land, and that she would help them measure the piece of land, because if it was not measured, then people will come and displace them.
The Lacandon, on the verge of extinction, having lived in the jungle for hundreds of years, insulated from the rest of the world, wore long white tunics, grew their hair long, kind of in the style of the Ramones. I'm not sure if they maybe picked up a few albums, maybe some albums sold out of a crate.
Their bangs are on point.
They look good. The Bloms would begin making regular journeys to bring them modern tools and medicine, and probably Ramones albums, if the time checks out. And the Lacandons grew close to them, allowing them to document their way of life, their customs, beliefs, and respect for their land. Trudy was even allowed to witness Corandero rituals, no small feat, as women and outsiders were not allowed to observe. And all of this documentation the Bloms gathered from the Lacandons and the different Mayan people living around San Cristobal became activism that saved them from becoming extinct.
Without their work and research, what we know could have been totally lost. The Bloms would establish their home in San Cristobal as Casa Nabolom, or House of the Jaguar, which is still there to this day, which serves as an inn to fund its mission of preserving the indigenous heritage of Chiapas. But it also became a meeting place for those aligned with their pursuits. Guests like Diego Rivera, and for some reason, Henry Kissinger.
Mm.
I hope that Trudy fed him some rancid-ass tamales,
Trudy,
is all I'm gonna say.
She fed me a rancid tamale, but being that I have seen the deaths of millions of people, I've actually quite enjoyed it. It sat with my stomach intestines well. And if you think I'm going to pay for my crimes, you are wrong. I will live a long and prosperous life because America is a twisted and violent place surrounded by dark magic. Evil dark magic that all the way back from the days of the Masonics. keep going, please, Stephanie. I wish to hear more about Trudy Blom.
You wish to hear more about Trudy Blom.
Don't do it better than me. Don't you dare do it better than me and your wonderful voices.
is what I say to you.
Don't you steal my voice, I am Henriques, you are.
You don't want me to steal yours,
you are the shadow of Henry Kissinger, the dark shadow of Henry Kissinger. I am the true Henry Kissinger.
I am the light.
I have been doing my shadow work, no. And I think I have come face to face with my shadow. And I just...
Your chateau? Did you shat your pants, Henry Kissinger?
I've many times shat my pants when I'm excited about all the people and evil I've killed and unleashed on top of the world.
All right. I hope Trudy fed him some rancid-ass tamales. And, of course, she would soon become Leonora Carrington's link to all things Maya. Talk to the hand, Henry Kissinger. We're done.
I would speak around the hand. I do not know why I should.
Back to Mexico City. By the 1960s, Mexico was in the heyday of El Milagro Mexicano.
There is a musical interlude here. You cannot just go from one segment to the other without the musical interlude.
Sure, I can.
Maybe we will play some Rage Against the Machine for me.
Boy, I sure do hope you are enjoying the episode you are listening to right now. I'm Stephanie Duenas from Art Slice, and Art Slice does not run on Russell and I's blood, burnouts, and occasional meltdowns alone. This fun, free, and educational content also runs on the wonderful partnerships of support from our listeners. We still need your support buying books, hosting fees, and going to locations, and your partnership will help cover that.
And heck, Steph, don't forget about those podcast tariffs we have to pay for now. Whatever the level, the $2 level, the $5 level, we appreciate and accept your donations at any level. Don't want a reoccurring membership? We have many t-shirts standing by. The Lost Trace Witches t-shirt, the Creature Double Feature t-shirt.
Callers, operators are standing by. Pause this episode now and call patreon.com/artslicepod or call artslicepod.com/shop for those wearables, and why not join our completely free algorithm-free newsletter while you were there. Okay, back to the show. Back to Mexico City. Mm. By the 1960s, Mexico is in the heyday of the Mexican Miracle, or El Milagro Mexicano, which was a period of rapid economic expansion, industrialization, and urban development that began in the 1950s and would last until the 1970s. In 1963, Mexico City received word that they had won the hosting rights for the 1968 Olympics. Basically, Mexico had some pesos to throw around, and they needed to invest in advancements like infrastructure and hydraulic water systems, as we will see in a future episode. But also, they wanted to wow those international crowds that would visit during the future Olympics, so they ramped up their investment in arts and culture. As you may recall from our last two episodes on Rosa Rolanda and Miguel Covarrubias, for decades, there had been a growing interest in rediscovering Mexico's overlooked past, and that archaeological research would result in thousands and thousands of artifacts and objects, both tiny and monumental, in need of a forever home. So with all of that Milagro dinero and the Olympics on the way, construction of the future National Museum of Anthropology began in El Bosque de Chapultepec, or, as it directly translates, Chapultepec Forest. It is what Central Park is to New York City, but about twice the size. It actually comes from the Nahuatl phrase, at the Grasshopper Hill.
Ooh.
Love it.
So whether it's all those grasshopper statues.
Yeah.
All right, mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah, Chapulines. Yeah. Officially opening in 1964, the National Museum of Anthropology is today the largest in Latin America, and it is one of the most visited in the world. Mm.
The museum was designed to not only display its most treasured ancient art and artifacts, but, like the Mexican muralists had been doing for decades, tell a comprehensive story of the various indigenous peoples of Mexico. For its grand opening, the museum selected contemporary artists to bridge that gap, to create a dialogue linking Mexico's complex historical legacy to its contemporary culture, with surprising and bold contemporary art.
Sounds like an updated take on the tradition of Mexican muralists.
Exactly, yes. And those muralists were now old guards, right? Diego Rivera, Jose Clemente Orozco, and David Siqueiros, now well into their 70s and or deceased. And they were no longer the default choice, especially if they were deceased. Yes, there are already plenty of their murals all over the city. But also, who better to bridge that history and wow international visitors than internationally minded Mexican artists, right?
Right. So if you're coming from New York City for the Olympics or just a visit, you're going to be surprised to see artwork that, while speaking to that Mexican heritage, is in the style of something a bit more European, maybe a little bit Abex, if you're feeling spicy.
Oh, spicy. I thought you were going to say frisky.
Frisky, spicy, okay. Fricey.
Fricey.
Well, if you're feeling fricey.
So those current day and forerunners of that breakaway generation who, as a reminder, broke away from that more socially minded, didactic Mexican muralism style would be the first to get the nod. Okay, we have 64-year-old Mexican Rufino Tamayo, 73-year-old Guatemalan Mexican Carlos Mérida, and, of course, 46-year-old British Mexican Leonora Carrington.
Two-thirds of those are still pretty old, Stephanie.
They are. And spoiler, LC was either designated or wanted to do the Maya of the Chiapas. Mm. And while it was an honor for LC to be included...
And to be honest, she probably definitely needed the money.
We all do. Like,
all of us.
It seems that she took accepting this commission very seriously because there were several things to consider. Mm. First was a logistical issue, right? Her works at this time were smaller, easy to make in that home/studio/kennel/nursery/kitchen/junk store/empty cardboard box repository. Yes. So working on a work of this size alone, much less in her home/studio/kennel, all the things,
cardboard box
was gonna be a challenge.
Mm-hmm. And Remedios Varo had turned down a different mural commission offer because I think the logistics just were gonna be too crazy.
It's overwhelming.
Yeah,
it's a lot
really
of work.
You gotta, it's insane.
You need a team of people most of the time.
Especially think about the detailed work they both do.
Yeah.
Trying to do this in a mural would be insane.
Yes. All right. Secondly, was the question of her ability to accurately tell the Chiapas Maya story while honoring her own approach to art making. And we know that she already had a deep reverence for indigenous cultures and that she had been enamored with the Mayan creation story, right? The Quiche Popol Vuh. Mm. Like we mentioned, Chiapas had many Mayan sects with differing beliefs that had evolved over time since the arrival of the Spanish. If the mural was going to act as a true account, filtered through her own LC lens, we can assume that she felt strongly that it would need to represent the people who lived that history, and thus meeting with the people of Chiapas firsthand would offer the most insight.
Of course.
Which was something that she might have learned while traveling to visit curanderos with Lejorne Chirut.
Beep.
Wow.
Is that her name?
No.
Beep.
Lorette Sejourne.
Thank you. I don't know what
happened. Wow. Is that a spoonerism or is that something, a spreadsheetism?
Yeah, spreadsheet over here. And also, just being in Chiapas itself would likely spur inspiration, right? You know, all of the, what are we feelings? Mm-hmm. What are we tastings? Mm-hmm. What's the humidity's likes?
So unlike Tamayo and Merida, who chose to make abstracted works, probably from readily available texts, LC would go to the highlands of Chiapas.
Now, Stephanie, now spreadsheet. Do you think she maybe focused her magic into kind of like a time-space rift that she could pass through only after her physical body had dissolved and like reconstituted her molecules as a glowing, thrumming orb of light, which in order to cast, she would first have to channel her energy into an astral sort of projection duplicate of herself. Because the duplicate was needed to perform the ritual because they needed two people of similar wavelengths, of similar spiritual wavelengths to create the correct ritual. Nah. Otherwise, it might pass her into another realm that she didn't want to go to, maybe like a bus stop somewhere in like New Jersey.
No, she didn't. And even if she could, I think she was in for the adventure.
Okay,
because she went by bus, but also train. And this was not just like a few hours. This was a days long journey to an area that did not see very many tourists, let alone wild haired white women.
Mm. She brought her hyenas, a couple of them, right?
Oh, shit. I forgot about those. Do you think she had like a Batman light to call them?
I think they're always around.
In the shape of a hyena. You think so?
Yeah. Kennel. Kennels used to describe her home. They don't say what was living in the kennel.
They don't. I just assumed cats.
Yeah.
But I guess the hyena is kind of a cat.
They're kind of a fucked up looking
dog cat.
Jaguar dog cat.
Wow. This odd pairing, Elsie and the Maya, was seeming more and more like a perfect fit. She sets out to honor their experience by capturing a vision of their past, present, and current-day descendants living under Spain's lasting mark on their beautiful mountains, dense jungles, and of course, their mythologies, layers of their beliefs, and their syncretistic whole. This mural is gonna get so layered, you guys. So fucking layered. Like a cake. Like a delicious cheesecake. I am craving cake. I am craving layers of cheesecakes.
Yes, you are.
Yes. So because, not because I'm craving cheesecake, but because this is about to get
mostly
so layered,
cheesecake, yeah.
We should stop the episode here.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
I'd prefer not to, but there's still a lot more to go. And we have been recording for most of the day.
Listeners, we will be back very soon with part a dose.
Remember to rate, review, and subscribe so we can reach more folks like yourself. Send the show to a friend if you want to. And then, yeah, rate it as well. That'd be helpful.
Yes. Nada menos que cinco estrellas. No less than 5 stars, please.
Go to artslicepod.com to sign up for our totally free newsletter so that you can get alerts to our latest episodes, because those algorithms sometimes don't alert you to our latest episodes, especially since we post them irregularly.
Regularly. Because electronic email, is that why? Sure.
Don't look into that closely.
Okay. All right. We could always use your support in creating these episodes. You can grab some merch if possible, or you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/artslicepod if you can in any way, shape, or form. We appreciate it from the bottom of our little corazones.
See.
We love you. Disgusting piece of shit. Hope he's rotting in hell.
You are not into a fan of rehabilitation, and I think that is a flaw on your part. We all deserve to be rehabilitated. Even I, Henry Kissinger, who is responsible for the deaths of millions and millions of peoples. But your child, if you choose to have one, because I'm now woke, but in this sort of capitalist way, will. Woke only really means that I am appealing to a broad base of constituents who will buy my products. That's how I mean woke. I don't mean actually woke. That's usually how it's used. Because it's not like Target is woke. I mean, they look at what they've done recently. Look at the backlash and, oh, now they're woke again. Okay. Only because it affected their consumer base. But yeah. Do they pay their employees more? No. The thing is, you know, I think in our search to get information faster, we miss the finer points, and then really what happens is you have all this knowledge that you easily at your fingertips, but do you really experience the knowledge? Do you really soak in the knowledge? Do you really know it, or do you forget it as quickly as it comes in? And that's why I think Henry Kissinger, think research is important. I also think you should pay your employees a living wage. I think CEOs maybe... I was misguided, and I think maybe CEO should have been the one I genocided. But if we could maybe hold a conference and say we're all going to make billions of dollars, and then all of a sudden they're surrounded by landmines. How do you feel about that? And then there's profit sharing and all the employees have a stake in the company, and I think the world gets a little bit better. You know? then maybe we have more time to learn. When we're working less hours, we don't need these fucking 30-second videos that explain the whole life of an artist and thought, how can you do that? You know, it boils my blood. I feel the rage growing inside me. And I want your child, if you choose to have one, because it is your choice. It's your body, your choice. I'm woke now. It's your body, your choice. And you should decide if you have a child. But they should be able to learn and experience life. If they have survived the evil I've unleashed into this world, your kid could indeed, with much training and much dedication and hundreds of hours of working and grit and determination, your kid may, just maybe, would have been able to paint that.
Wow. Who knew Henry Kissinger would be the positive one?